And so I would ask if you would to please stand as we read our sermon passage, Revelation 4, verses 1 through 11. After these things, I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking with me, saying, "Come up here, and I will show you things which must take place after this." Immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne set in heaven, and the one sat on the throne. And he who sat there was like a jasper and a sardius stone in appearance. And there was a rainbow around the throne, in appearance like an emerald. Around the throne were 24 thrones, and on the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in white robes, and they had crowns of gold on their heads. And from the throne proceeded lightnings and thunderings and voices. Seven lamps of fire were burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. Before the throne there was a sea of glass like crystal. And in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures full of eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion, the second living creature like a calf, the third living creature had a face like a man, and the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle. The four living creatures, each having six wings, were full of eyes around and within. They do not rest day or night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." Whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to him who sits on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who sits on the throne and worship him who lives forever and ever, and cast their thrones before the throne, their crowns before the throne, saying, "You are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they exist and were created." And may the Lord add his blessings to the reading and understanding that comes from his word. Please be seated. You can tell I get excited about this stuff. I want to speak to you this morning, as by way of introduction to this passage, about the dangers of target fixation. Now, back in the old days, before dive bombers had computers to drop their bombs, the pilot had to roll his airplane pretty much upside down and pull the nose down to about a 45 or 60 degree dive. And then he had to line up the track of the airplane. As an airplane goes down like this, it doesn't just point at the target. You actually have the nose pointed down, and it's moving at a 45 degree angle this way. So the nose is tracking across the ground. And the pilot's bomb sight then is tracking along behind the nose, of course. And so what it's showing you is where the bomb would supposedly fall, would hit, if you were to release it at that point. And what you're trying to do as you go down that dive is that you're trying to match the airspeed that is gaining with the actual altitude that you have calculated for the bomb release, and that target site, that bomb site, should be on the target right there as all of that comes together. And then you hit the pickle, the bomb comes off, and somewhere down there the bomb hits, and you hope it's pretty close to the target. Well, as you can imagine, that requires some pretty extreme concentration. You have to really focus on stuff. You have to make sure the airplane is moving on the sideways. You have to account for drift from the wind. And also, too, when the bomb releases, this is very important, you got to pull that airplane up like crazy. Because if you don't and the bomb goes off, you can actually fly into the shrapnel shroud that comes up from the bomb. It's right below you. You know, the bomb's moving the same speed you are. So it hits the ground, and then, of course, all of its blast goes up, and you don't want to be down there in that blast, so you've got to pull hard to get up. Now, back in the old days, pilots would often get what's called target fixation. They would be so caught up, notice this phrase, in the here and now of tracking the target and all the stuff that's going on with tracking that target, that they would lose sight of their altitude. And they would go too low. More than one pilot has flown into the ground this way, on a target run, bomb run, and didn't notice its altitude, pulls up, and the airplane just couldn't pull up in time and plows into the ground. Others, particularly in combat, have come back with great big holes in their wing from where they got too low and they went through the bomb blast and got shrapnel hits. And so, what is this all about? And why do you care? Well, you see, the pilots lost sight of the big picture. Now, everything was set up for that. They lost their situational awareness. Now, brothers and sisters, that can be deadly. Well, target fixation, as I've just explained, it doesn't just happen to dive bomber pilots. Christians can become so fixated on their immediate lives that they lose sight of the big picture. They lose situational awareness. And Jesus has given us this letter, this revelation, to correct that problem. This letter does indeed speak to the future, but the future is, while it points to what's ahead of us, the future is there in terms of what we need now. Because the focus in this letter, or this revelation, is the life in this real world as we're going through it right now. It's about how we're to understand our lives as we live them, with all of the ups and downs. And it talks about the world as we see it down here. And it teaches us that we're supposed to see the world down here in terms of what is up there in the heavenly realm. And that's why God, Jesus actually, in this opening verses, in this chapter today, says, come up here, I'm going to show you things, and especially things that are going to happen soon. Revelation is here to point us to the truth of our present circumstances. Our present circumstances now, ours. So that we don't become fixated on our target in the world around us and lose sight of the big picture of what's really happening. In chapters 1 and 3 that we have just finished up, John, who was receiving this revelation, had his eyes firmly fixed on this world. He saw a vision of Jesus in chapter 1 as he is manifested in time and space in history now. He saw a vision of Jesus amidst his churches, in his church across the world. And each church had its spiritual essence in his hand. And so that passage, John 1, talks about this world and how we should see this world, and it talks about how we should see it in terms of Jesus being here in the midst of his churches. And then he went further on to give a particular attention to 7 individual churches in Asia. Now, these were real, live, actual, historical churches, as we kind of went out of our way to emphasize as we talked about each one of them. And so they existed in space and time. And each letter was focused on the events that were going on in that church at that point in time. So John was, in essence, in chapters 1, 2, and 3, focused on this world. He was focused on what was going on in God's hand in this world. And now we shift into the whole rest of Revelation, where God is going to take us and say, okay, stuff going on in the world, this is what's really going on behind it. Beginning with chapter 4 today, we are being given an overall perspective that the churches in Asia should have had in order to see their remaining existence, but also to see the real problems that we face in terms of what Jesus is showing John in heaven. The cure for Laodicea, which we talked about last, and Philadelphia, and all the rest of them, was not to be that they would just have to sit down and pull up their bootstraps and get on with being teeth gritted, stubborn, plowing through whatever life was presenting to them. They, like Joseph in the Old Testament, had to see that the stuff they were going through, while the world may have meant it for evil, God has meant it for good. And that's the shift in focus that the Revelation presents to us, for us to understand. And we then, if I will allow me to continue the analogy, if we embrace this picture as it's presented to us, then we will gain situational awareness, and we can successfully finish the mission that God gives us on earth without flying into the ground. Jesus says, "Come up here and see." Well, let's go up there with John and see what he saw. First thing that we need to notice is that John sees an open door, and then he hears a voice. The two things we need to get from this. First, there is a door that John sees that he is to spiritually enter. And secondly, we need to note that this voice that is said is the first voice, the same voice he heard before, and that goes back to chapter 1, verse 10, and that was indeed Jesus. Now, so taking that second aspect first, we need to remember that it was Jesus who was speaking like a loud trumpet. The voice that we saw in chapter 1 was Jesus himself, the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega. So we're confident here that Jesus himself is telling John to come up and see. But what about this door business? John didn't have to go through a door to see Jesus in chapter 1. What's important about this door is that it's standing open. And that implies that that's not the usual case. This door is normally closed. Now here's where we begin to get a first down payment on how we really need to understand the world around us in its fullness. Brothers and sisters, in our normal experience, we are cut off from heavenly things that are going on all around us. We're cut off from it. But that doesn't mean they're not there and that they are indeed happening. When Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden, the gate clanged shut behind them. Fallen mankind, because of the fall, is unable to bridge the gap between us as we exist in the realm of our five senses in space and time and the spiritual dimension, which makes up the rest of creation. When God created everything, he created the heavens and the earth. Yes, physically there were the heavens that are above us. But brothers and sisters, God also created the spiritual heavens. As he populated the earth with physical creatures, he also populated the spiritual dimension with angels and, yes, demons and stuff. So, the Bible doesn't picture this heavenly dimension we're talking about as being out there somewhere, out beyond what used to be a planet Pluto, and, you know, out in the constellation somewhere. No. Physically, the heavens are the cosmos above us, but that's not the heavens we're talking about here, and they're not distant from us. We live in the midst of this spiritual dimension. It's all around us. And occasionally, God allows us to break through, people to break through, and to have sight into this spiritual dimension. Remember Jacob and his famous vision of the ladder? He saw God, you know, and he saw the ladder and angels coming up and going down. And this is referenced, of course, in the New Testament in Hebrews. So there is a sense, as Hebrews teaches us, that the angels are ministering servants and they're coming, you know, from the spiritual dimension, not from a physical heaven above our heads. But they're coming from the spiritual dimension to serve us. Remember Elisha and how he prayed for his servant to have his eyes open to see what was already there? And his servant turns and looks, and the whole population on the top of the hills all around him are a glittering army full of chariots and horses and stuff. They were there, but God had to open his eyes or open a door for him to see it. So, brothers and sisters, we're not alone in this sanctuary. Okay. We are in the presence of a multitude of witnesses, angelic as well, I believe, as the souls of the saints who have gone before us. I know it sounds a bit weird, but it's the truth. The door of our senses is shut, but that doesn't mean the door is not there and that the spiritual dimension is not real. The world as we experience it with our five senses is not all there is. The door is closed to us, but the truth of this world must be understood in terms of what's behind that door. And it was that door that was open to John and is open to us so that we can know the truth about our lives in terms of both dimensions in which we exist. The physical dimension and the spiritual dimension. Now, what about this heavenly realm does God open up to us in chapter 4? Well, the first thing that impresses us when we break through into this spiritual dimension, as it's open to us in the Bible, is that the God who created the heavens and the earth and all things in it is sitting on a throne. And he is sovereignly ruling over all things. Chapters 4, 5, and 6, as I said, are the heart of this book. Everything before and everything after those chapters either expands upon what is being taught in these three chapters or else gives an application to it. And here, behind the door, we see the foundation on which our lives are to be built and to be lived. The God who created this world is right now sitting on his throne. And he is with full knowledge and control of everything that is happening in it. Now, you see that before him, in front of the throne, is the sea. We're going to talk about this more as we move into chapter 5 and subsequent. But the sea that is before his throne there, think of it as being all of history. In other words, right from his throne, God sees everything that is created, that he has created, and as it progresses in time. He sees the first and the last. He sees everything that's happening in space and time because the sea is history. It is that which is our life and times going through it. Now, how should we respond to this? God on his throne, with all of history open before him, not as if it's happening and he's just watching like we'd watch a TV show. No, it's because that's what he has sovereignly decreed. That is what he is doing. He is seeing his works as in terms of history. Now, right away, we ought to be impressed. Like that old praise song, "Our God is an awesome God. He reigns in heaven above." Well, it was true. John's first glimpse into heaven, like his first glimpse of Jesus in chapter 1, is meant to astonish us. That's what the effect is supposed to be on us, brothers and sisters. He's not really up there, you know, looking like a piece of glass, you know, those fancy stones that he's described as. There's no way in the world to interpret what he actually looked like in John's vision, so those are approximations. The point of it is, he's pretty impressive, awesome, and he's supposed to bring us to our knees like it did to Isaiah in chapter 6 of his book. So he's described as an appearance like precious stones, and that's because John sees him as incredible, incredible beyond description. I hate it when people use words in such a way as to cause them to lose their true sense. When you tell a waitress what you want from the menu, and she says, perfect, I will usually, to the discomfiture of my wife, always, but I will usually say, no, it's not perfect, but it is what I want. Yeah. The word perfect means something other than that. Another word that is used way too often to the point that it loses its meaning is the word awesome. I have not broken my son's misuse of this word to this day, and he's approaching 40 years old. But I have never given up. Brothers and sisters, awesome is not awesome unless it fills you with awe. And what does it mean to be filled with awe? When we are consumed by awe, we can't really speak. We just stand there with our mouths open and say, look at that. That's awesome. Many things in this world can fill us with moments of awe. But brothers and sisters, God on his throne should fill us with a lifetime of awe. Every day. And I would suggest that if that is not present in our lives, if we do not awaken every day to some extent of being in awe of our God sitting on his throne, with our life right before him and our world right before him, if we're not in awe of that, then I would suggest that we may already be experiencing target fixation. We are overly concerned with our world as it presents itself to us and not concerned with the world as it really is, including our spiritual dimension. If we see the bigger picture of God as he is presented to us here, we can't help but respond in awe. I've read this chapter, I don't know, 1,000 times. But every time I read it, I feel my heart surging with the idea of what our God, how awesome our God really is. Everything else that fills us with awe in this world, as we stand on a mountaintop looking at a gorgeous sunset, is just a down payment on the awesome nature of our God. And that's our life, and our life needs to reflect that. The next thing we see in here is that God presents himself in such a way that we are to embrace God and understand how to apply this awe that his image evokes in us in our lives. Well, God presents himself to us in this chapter in terms of the covenant of peace, that passage that David read earlier, talked about from Isaiah. That God is the covenant God of peace, and again, in that passage, it was associated with a rainbow. Now, God presents himself to us in this passage as being seated in the midst of a rainbow. And when we get over into chapter 10, we'll find Jesus presenting himself as having a rainbow on his head. Now, here, the entire Trinity, as our Creator God, seated on the throne in imagery, is proclaiming a covenant of peace with his creation. This all goes back to Genesis 9 and the days of Noah after the flood, where God specifically calls it a covenant of peace. Now, what does that mean for us? It means that when we look around our lives, and perhaps we're going through a time of that, and it appears to us like everything is going to hell in a handbasket, then we need to get back to this, that no matter how bad things may seem to us, our God has bound himself with an oath. that no matter how difficult the life we face or the world in which we live, no matter how much creation is groaning under the weight of man's sin and longs for the day that the sons of God will be revealed, no matter how bad that may be, God is not going to destroy this world again. He's not going to do it. This is his world. He created it, and he has sworn by himself that he will never again visit it with destruction like he did before. He has declared peace, and he will have it. And God will not only have his peace, God intends to share his peace with this world, with his elect. It is his delight to proclaim that you and I together will have a part in God sharing his peace with his creation. Let that sink in the next time the world just seems to be impossible to live in, when it just seems too overwhelming. Stop and think. God is on his throne, and he has declared peace with this world. Now look at those four strange beasts that stand around the throne. As you can tell, we can only hit the high points in this chapter. But look at those four beasts. We'll come back to the 24 elders. The beasts are very important symbols in Revelation. We're going to see beasts here and beasts there all throughout. And we must realize that they symbolize something that is real in the world, but is not a physical reality. In other words, they represent a spiritual truth about actual stuff in the world. Now, these beasts then represent something real in the world. What is it? Well, there are four of them. They surround the throne. All of them have wings and eyes all over their body. Now, this particular imagery is drawn from the Old Testament in Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 1 through 14. And so it's not new imagery as far as the Christians of God's day. But to understand it, we need to look at it. There's one like a lion. It's a wild four-footed beast. There's one like a calf. That's a domesticated animal. There's one like a man, two-footed and upright. And there's one like an eagle, two-footed flying creature. So we see all of God's living creatures that exist on the earth and above the earth. And I don't want to quibble about the fish. Okay? The fish aren't here. The fish aren't kind of in the same league here. You would think of fish being maybe not noble. But the point is, God is surrounded by his creatures. And they are everywhere. That's the meaning of all of those eyes. That no matter where they are throughout all of God's creation, all of his living creatures, they all have eyes so that they're able to behold their God. Now that's what they are. Well, what is their purpose? Their purpose is right there in the passage. Look at what they do. These beasts exist to give glory to God by singing of him as being holy, holy, holy. The God who was and is to come. And notice this song. It is a different thrust from the one that the elders sing. It's the purpose of creation that is being here. Creation, all of creation, is there to proclaim the eternal constant, which is God himself. Calling his eternal power and Godhead, as Paul says in Romans 1. And if it wasn't for that door being closed, brothers and sisters, no man could walk on this planet and not see that that's what all of creation is proclaiming. If that door wasn't shut, we would all, just by virtue of living in this world, have our eyes drawn to the God who created it. So, back to the main point, especially for us, what's being taught here is that all of God's creatures, including mankind, were created to sing his praise, to proclaim him as the holy, 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 all-powerful God that is at the center of our lives. Take that and think about it. We're filled with awe each day that no matter what we're going through, God is on his throne, and he is magnificent beyond all description. And not only that, but he is all-powerful and holy and holy and holy. And it is my privilege to proclaim that. Can you say that your days proclaim the glory of God? Can you think of how, in your ordinary life, the fabric of giving praise to God for his person as a God who is just worthy to be praised is built into it? As we move toward the close, the last major symbol is the 24 elders. Here we have a major subset of all creation. The four beasts are all creation considered as an abstract whole. But these 24 represent the elect from the Old and New Testament people of God. 12 elders from the Old Testament, 12 from the New. They all sit on thrones, talking about exercising dominion over under God, over the earth. This takes us back to Genesis 1, 28 and 29. Notice they all have crowns of gold and are dressed in white robes. The crowns are their mission calling. You, brother or sister, have a crown. That crown is what your mission calling, your purpose of serving God on this earth is. It's summed up in the elders because we're all, if you will, subsumed under their headship. But that's what they are. The white robes represent the purity that we have before God. In the spiritual dimension, brothers and sisters, that you exist in that spiritual dimension, God does not see you as being filthy. He sees you as being pure, dressed in perfect white robes, washed in the blood of the Lamb. So here we see the elders singing out the glory of our holy God. And they praise God not only as the creator of all things, but the ones in whom they exist. What does this all come together in? It means that all creation, both the redeemed of God and the elders, and creation as a whole, exist to sing in a heavenly chorus. Next time you have your choir come up here, think about that. We're all part of the choir. And that's why we have been created. Now, what should we take from this chapter? There's much more that can be said about it. We've touched the high points. But here's what we can say with absolute certainty. Chapter 4 points us towards the absolute truth about every age and every life in the progress of history. Chapter 4 is not just about what lies ahead of us. It's about the truth of the past, the present, and the future. It proclaims to us that there is a spiritual dimension of all history, and that it is in the spiritual dimension of history that the understanding of all things that happen in history are to be understood. We will be building on that for the rest of Revelation. That means the spiritual dimension of life is how you understand your life in it. With spiritual eyes, we can embrace the truth that God is even now sitting on his throne in unimaginable splendor. He is awesome in the real sense of the word. And if we're going to have a cure for being too fixated on this world and letting this world beat us into a pulp, it's going to be by breaking through that and seeing our God sitting on his throne and declaring peace with his world and having us as part of his peace. We were created to sing his praise. in all things, in every age, in every circumstance, no matter what we face, because the God of peace has declared peace with us. That is the most basic fact of our lives, yours and mine, and it's the basic fact of life for Liberty Presbyterian Church. Let's pray.